This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Greetings, all you atheists and agnostics and other freethinkers. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. And it is April. I saw some crocus coming out of the garden this morning.
That's
and
right, our
what
garden.
Are those, what are those little white
snowdrops?
Snowdrops are coming up, so tis the season for spring. This show, the Free Thought Radio, is a product of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We work to keep state and church separate and to educate the public about the views of those of us who don't believe, atheists and agnostics and all the nuns of the above. And we have a very special guest today. Of course, all of our guests are very special, but an very special guest, Dr. Paul R. Ehrlich. He's the president for the Center for Conservation Biology, the Bing Professor of Population Studies. His newest book is The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, co-written with his wife, Ann Ehrlich.
And we've always hoped to have Professor Ehrlich on as a guest. The announcement last month from the National Center for Health Statistics is what spurred me on. The center announced that the total number of U.S. births in 2007, which was over 4 million, was the highest on record, surpassing the peak baby boom year of 1957. And, of course, the statistics show that teenage births have risen for a second year in a row after a 14-year decline. So this is a good time to call in Paul Ehrlich.
We'll talk with him in the second half of our show. But first, we want to take a little time to talk about the Freedom From Religion Foundation, our hot new lawsuit challenging the National Day of Prayer. We're suing President Obama now and his press secretary, although when we started the lawsuit, it was President George Bush. We're also naming Shirley Dobson of the National Day of Prayer Task Force. She's married to the founder of Focus on the Family, of course, James Dobson, there in Colorado Springs, because our lawsuit is alleging a hand-in-glove relationship between the government and many governors and the Religious Right National Day of Prayer Task Force, which is headed by Shirley Dobson.
Since the first Thursday in May, which is the official National Day of Prayer, as enacted by Congress, is going to be here before you know it, our lawsuit is starting to get some attention.
A radical group from Wisconsin is suing to put an end to what thousands of Americans have cherished throughout our nation's history. In 1775, the First Continental Congress called for it. So did President Abraham Lincoln in 1863. A tradition followed by Presidents Truman, Reagan, Clinton, and Bush. Like Thanksgiving or Christmas, it's a national observance. It's on all Hallmark calendars. It's observed annually across the country. What is it that this group wants to silence forever? The National Day of Prayer.
That's part of a video by the Alliance Defense Fund, which is a religious right legal organization that is defending Shirley Dobson in our challenge of her role over the National Day of Prayer.
And this video sounds very ominous, and it makes us sound very ominous. It's as if prayer is going to be outlawed.
They had a picture of a guy with his mouth duct taped, like we're trying to silence free speech.
But they also showed the foundation's very pretty Imagine No Religion billboard, which I always like to see.
By the way, I saw our bus sign yesterday, Sleeping on Sundays, for the first time. Have you seen it yet?
No, Madison, here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Boy, what would Shirley Dobson think of that?
So
let's talk a little bit about the history behind the National Day of Prayer. When did it start?
Well, the National Day of Prayer was enacted during the McCarthy era in 1952. It was one of the first of this, I don't know, there were three or four very retrograde acts by Congress to introduce religion into government. And so it was in 1952 that Congress ordered that there should be a National Day of Prayer. And what's fascinating is that we found out in looking at the congressional record that the National Day of Prayer legislation is based on a lie. It's based on disinformation. It's based on a historical falsehood. And in the actual record from the Senate debate and the statement that was made, this is the rationale that Congress made use of to enact the National Day of Prayer. I'm quoting from it. When the delegates to the Constitutional Convention encountered difficulties in the writing and formation of a constitution for this nation, prayer was suggested and became an established practice at succeeding sessions. Now, Dan, you know that's a lie.
Well, Benjamin Franklin suggested prayer, but his motion was turned down, and there was no prayer at the Constitutional Convention.
That's right, and in fact, I mean, it's in all of the records. You know, the Constitutional Convention was very well recorded, and actually, Benjamin Franklin was a secretary, so he recorded in his own minutes that only three or four people were interested in it, and it just died. And they adjourned.
And Madison took extensive notes, and there's nothing in there about any prayer.
And there was a feeling of some embarrassment as well. And so this is a lie, and this lie is repeated over and over again in the National Day of Prayer proclamations given by presidents. I made a count. There have been 56 of them since 1952, and over 10% of the proclamations mention and say or strongly imply that there was prayer at the adoption of the Constitution. And what they are mixing this up with is the Continental Congress, which was what was in charge during the Revolutionary War and adopted the Articles of Confederation, and of course it was a very disastrous constitution, and it was totally failed, and we never think about it anymore because it was a disaster. But under the Articles of Confederation, there was no separation of church and state, and so they did have prayer once a year during the Continental Congress when it was in session. So this is what they're all mixing up with. They're conflating the two things, and very deliberately, in fact.
But how did our country survive anyway until 1952? I mean, two world wars and a civil war and a depression without a National Day of Prayer. This is a Johnny-come-lately thing anyway.
Right. And so what we also found out is that the person most responsible for enacting a National Day of Prayer is...
Billy Graham.
Billy Graham. And he came and had, like, I don't know, 9-week... revival or something.
He called it a crusade.
In Washington, D.C., and then they had this big prayer thing on the steps of the Capitol, and then he's the one who suggested it. And so this is a Christian minister, and so this is, you know, although there's not a lot of Christianity in the proclamations themselves, it was all suggested by Christianity. It's been bolstered today by the very Christian right focus on the family's National Day of Prayer Task Force.
Well, it looks like the proclamations don't want to deliberately offend Jews, but they do want to offend us non-believers.
Well, they all use wording like all I urge all Americans, I encourage all Americans, I invite all Americans, I ask all Americans to pray. Or they use the word every American or each American, and or say citizens of the United States, which basically disenfranchises those of us who don't believe in a God, who think that prayer it's just wishful thinking, and that you cannot suspend the natural laws of the universe by prayer. And so let's, I think there's a little...
Don't they say that in that video,
right.
That it's all Americans? What did they say?
The National Day of Prayer is for everybody.
The National Day of Prayer is for everybody.
That was the Alliance Defense Fund.
Yeah, defending it. And it's that assumption that gets to the heart of our lawsuit. The National Day of Prayer is not for everyone, but everyone is being told, urged, encouraged, invited, and directed to pray every year by the president and by all of the governors and many of the local public officials at county or city levels, which is the goal of the National Day of Prayer Task Force, to dictate a specific proclamation which is picked up by every public official uniformly.
Under Reagan, what had been a floating holiday until then, the National Day of Prayer happened all over the place. He decided, I think, at the instigation of Focus on the Family, to make it the first Thursday in May. And since that time, the proclamations have become much more proselytizing. There's more reference to scripture. Some of them are exact replicas of templates that are suggested by the National Day of Prayer Task Force that's run by Focus on the Family. So we are arguing in our lawsuit that there's a hand-in-glove relationship between the government now and a Christian right organization.
So is our lawsuit trying to muzzle free speech and freedom of religion?
No, there is no country where people have more ability to pray if they want. We just think it is totally inappropriate for the commander-in-chief to act as if he's the minister-in-chief.
So those people can pray if they want to, anytime, any place. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio over Air America Radio. We'll be right back to celebrate the birthday and the music of E.Y. Yip Harburg, one of America's greatest and most irreverent lyricists, and then to speak with population expert Paul Ehrlich.
The world is overcrowded. They're dying of starvation. And you tell us what we need is a prayer. With just one word from you, we could control the population. But no, you're too religious to care. Pope, Pope, stay away. Don't come back some other day.
Find out more about Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at FFRF.org or phone 1-800-335-4021.
If you don't believe in God, or if you have a problem with organized religion, there is a new radio show just for you. The Liberal Radio Network, Air America, has a new program called Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. We're back, and we'll be speaking with Paul Ehrlich about his new book on evolution, as well as just how fast that population bomb is ticking.
But before we do that, we want to pay homage to one of the greatest of the American lyricists, E.Y. Yip Harburg, born in 1896 on April the 8th. Yip, known as Broadway's social conscience, began writing lyrics for Broadway revues, including that classic anthem of the Depression, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, with composer Jay Gorney in 1932, April in Paris. And he also wrote the lyrics to over 600 songs, a variety of composers, including It's Only a Paper Moon, and of course the lyrics to The Wizard of Oz, including the award-winning Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And now we'll play Ain't It the Truth, a song written for the first black Hollywood musical, Cabin in the Sky. This is a Yip Harburg song that was cut from the film as being too irreverent, but Lena Horne later recorded it.
Life is short, short, brother. Ain't it the truth? And there is no other. Ain't it the truth? You got to rock that rainbow while you still got your youth. Ain't it the solid truth? Was a guy named Adam. Ain't it the truth? Said now, look here, madam. Truth, you got to bite that apple while you still got your tooth. Ain't it the mellow truth? Lord gave us wine and gin to drown our troubles in. What's all this talk of sin? Rise and shine and fall. New religion, ain't it the truth? For you is dead pigeon. Ain't it the truth? 'Cause when you laid horizontal in that telephone booth, there'll be no breathing spell. It's only natural. Ain't it the gossip? Life is short, short, brother. Ain't it the truth? And there is no other. Ain't it the truth? So if you don't love living, then you're slightly uncouth. Ain't it the dignified truth? Said that gal, DuBarry. Ain't it the truth. Love is cash and carry. Ain't it the truth? You got to shake it down or mix it up with vermouth. Ooh, ain't it the visible, visible truth? Life is a rippling brook. Man is a fish to cook. You got to bait your hook. Rise and shine and cast your line. You got to get your possum. Ain't it the truth? While you're still in blossom. Ain't it the truth that went for Delilah, Cleopatra, and Ruth? Them babes did mighty swell. They rang that Jezebel. Ain't it the gossip held true? It's the truth, the truth. It's the solid, mellow truth.
That's Lena Horne singing the Yip Harburg lyrics, Ain't It the Truth. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. Don't miss our upcoming interview with Paul Ehrlich on evolution, the population bomb, and much more.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. Beware of dogma.
Free Thought Radio is back. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker.
And Dr. Paul R. Ehrlich is Bing, B-I-N-G, Bing Professor of Population Studies and Professor of Biological Sciences at Stanford University. His books include, of course, The Population Bomb and many others. He's written a lot about evolution, including The Process of Evolution, The Machinery of Nature, Betrayal of Science and Reason with his wife, Anne Ehrlich. He's an expert in the fields of evolution, ecology, taxonomy, and population biology. Their newest book that he and his wife, Anne Ehrlich, wrote it's called The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, just in time for the Darwin anniversary celebrations this year. Ehrlich is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He was awarded the first AAAS Scientific American Prize for Science in the Service of Humanity, recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship, among many other honors.
And we have Paul Ehrlich on the phone with us from his Stanford office. And I have to tell you, it's a thrill, Professor Ehrlich.
Oh, it's really nice to be here.
And I remember when your book came out, The Population Bomb.
You were 3 years old.
Well, I wish I were. I was in junior high school. And I remember when you came to the campus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It was standing room only. And my mother started a ZPG chapter here in Madison.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Great.
So,
how's she doing? Is she still alive?
She is. And
give her my best.
I will. And I went around for years wearing ZPG buttons. Stop it, too.
Of course, she had four children, so what do you say?
Well, Anne did, not
Anne
I.
Anne did, no.
Well, she had those before your book.
That's right.
So anyway, I know that we're going to talk about your book on evolution, natural evolution, but I did want to just briefly talk about the continuing population problem.
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, The Dominant Animal discusses that, too. It's basically the story of how we got where we are and where we're going. And part of it, of course, is our enormous population growth, which is having a huge effect on where we're going. For instance, you probably haven't noticed, but the national media have not mentioned a word about the role that the size of the American population plays in both our need for imported oil and the amount of greenhouse gases we emit.
Right.
You know, we
never hear it.
No, we have everybody celebrated going through 300 million people, even though if we had the 135 million we had at the end of the Second World War, we wouldn't be worried about importing so much oil, and we certainly wouldn't be worried as much about giving out greenhouse gases. And no one has ever come up with even a semi-sane reason why there ought to be more than 135 million Americans alive at one time. If we want the country to last for a long time, what we want to do is have maybe 100 million people for the next million years, not see how many we can cram in the next two or three decades and let the country be destroyed.
Yeah, and I bet you we wouldn't have all those telephone menus either.
Oh, yo, boy.
So how did you get to work today?
How did I get to work today? Walk. I walk
every day. Oh, you walk? Well, good for you.
One of the reasons I've stayed at Stanford is that you can live close enough here so that you can walk to work, and that's an enormous benefit compared with, say, driving an hour each way in a freeway with people shooting at you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're close enough to walk, too, from our office. It's
That's great.
About a 3 mile, so.
Now, I'm about two, so, but then again, I'm older than you are.
Well, just a little bit. The Dominant Animal is your newest book. It came out last year with your wife, Ann Ehrlich. And both of you pretty much co-research and co-write, is that right, as a team?
We have for 54-plus years now, yeah.
Wow, well, that's
nice. What a success story. And I've noticed, and I'm sure you have also, that almost every field these days, in the last 10, 20 years, almost every science book now has to refer to evolution as sort of the backdrop. And in The Dominant Animal, I notice you lay good groundwork for showing how our species became so, I guess I can use the word successful, how dominant on this planet. And yet you say we have the intellectual capabilities of dealing with the problem, but do we have the will?
Yeah, that I think is the big question. We're about 200,000 years old as a species, and the average mammal species lasts maybe a million years. So we're adolescents, and we're behaving like adolescents. We have enormous power. Our cultural evolution has given us incredible technological capability. But we haven't caught up in how we treat each other and how we treat the environment. I mean, think about it for a minute. If you compare London in 1500 with London today, look at the technological changes, which would dazzle somebody from even 1800. Airplanes, computers, on and on and on. But if Plato were reincarnated today, he would understand the ethical issues we face perfectly. In other words, we haven't changed our ethics and how we treat each other and how we treat our environment significantly since 4,000 years ago.
Well, we still
that's
get hungry.
Great.
We still get hungry, and we still breathe air, whether it's clean or dirty.
Yeah, that's true. And we are still reproducing much too rapidly, and we're consuming too much. And so our very dominance, the triumph of our dominance, our ability to change the atmosphere of the planet in ways that are not helpful to us, to empty the oceans of fishes, to coat the entire planet with toxic substances from pole to pole. We have more than 100,000 toxic substances we hardly understand interacting together and giving us nasty consequences, and yet we are not able to pull ourselves together and do something about it.
Well, the Bible says, be fruitful and multiply.
And subdue the earth. And as one of my, a Spanish lady I happen to know, when she had that quoted to her, and a very deeply religious Spanish lady, she said her response was, ya conquistada, it's subdued already.
The earth has been replenished, that's right.
That's right. Okay,
job done.
So it's a desperate situation that's also silly. I mean, you look at all of the conversation about climate change, which could be the most serious problem we face. It's not clear whether it or the deterioration of our epidemiological environment or the toxics or a nuclear war are worse prospects. But climate change is certainly up there in the public eye. Nothing anywhere in the world is being done about it. In other words, each year there's more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, not less. It's just talk, and that's not good.
You know, I think what you're saying about the adolescence of the species is true, because I get what you're saying now, but I didn't get it before in my earlier fundamentalist years, before I had four children, and then Annie Laurie and I got married, had a fifth one, and then I went out and I had a visit to the doctor because I realized, you know, what responsibility do I have? But how do we get the message to those teens and 20-somethings about the problem?
Well, one of the things we should do is start in kindergarten, but of course it's too late just to do that. We got to do adult education too. But I mean, why should you say see spot run when you could say see the plant grow in the sun and start making the connection to photosynthesis that would help people understand the world better? In other words, our educational systems are not tuned to really telling people how the world works, and that's one of the reasons we wrote The Dominant Animal. By the way, Stanford University. You can get all the way through without knowing a thing about science. I started teaching a course called Human Evolution in the Environment. And in fact, in 45 minutes, I'm going to teach it again because the average Stanford student gets through without knowing really how the world works. And many of our faculty don't have a clue either. I mean, how many people that you know can actually describe the difference between climate disruption and ozone depletion, for example, or do they know about the second law of thermodynamics and what that means to their everyday lives? To tell them anything at all about the limits on the human endeavor and so on? These things just aren't out there in our educational system, even though they're not all that complicated. And they could easily be taught a lot of it in grade school and high school. But mostly there's eventually an environmental science course which says we should recycle.
Books like yours do make it easy, a painless way to read. And your colleague there at Stanford, Robert Sapolsky, whom we've had on this show also.
Ah, yes, great guy.
Who also cares deeply about this big lacuna, this big gap in our education about science.
Yeah, no, Robert and I often, we occasionally write together, and we often have dismal lunches complaining about how you can't get the word out.
Two primates.
And I wanted to go back a little bit more to what you were talking about earlier, which is the lack of attention by the media to the problems that overpopulation contribute.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, when was the last time you heard anything about whether we needed a population policy in the United States? The media try and cover immigration without discussing population, which is like trying to tell an airplane designer, design me an airplane that'll load 100 people a minute. And when he says, how many should it fly with, says, don't worry about that, just load 100 a minute. The media do a dismal job.
Because this is it's somehow blasphemous to suggest that people should limit their birth?
Well, there are a number of reasons. They try and avoid controversy. They are largely owned by people who think the more people you have, the more consumption you'll have, and the more profits they'll have, or the bigger audiences they'll have, and so on. But I think the main reason is that, again, I hate to be a pedant, but you go back to the same excuse, and that is the educational answer. Who are the people in the media? They are a reasonable selection of bright people who have been trained in our school systems and universities. And since the school systems and universities don't teach any of this stuff, how can you expect them to know anything about it?
Well, I have to say, I was a journalism graduate, and I didn't get any of this. So
yeah,
you're right.
It's not. I mean, we've been struggling at Stanford for years to try and get science into the curriculum, and they have a committee working on it. It reminds me of a famous church council called the Council of Basel that went on just before the Reformation, went on for about 20 years and accomplished absolutely nothing. And I'm absolutely certain that's what's going to happen with this university committee. That's the way we're working on Council of Basel time when we should be working on the kind of time scale that we produced the A-bomb. This is an emergency we're in. And yet universities, school systems, the Congress and all are moving very slowly. The cheery news is that they finally have some first-rate science back in the government. The science advisor, John Holdren, is one of the most brilliant scientists in the world, knows everything that's in the dominant animal and elsewhere, and much more. Jane Lubchenco, who's running NOAA, is also a brilliant scientist. Varmus, who's going to be one of Holdren's colleagues on the President's Science Advisory Committee, is extremely good. So for the first time in 8 years, we have absolutely first-rate science rather than anti-science. I mean, science was hideously attacked in the last administration.
Well, we're going to talk more about that after our break. I'm Annie Laura Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio, and we are going to be back in a minute to talk with the renowned Paul Ehrlich about evolution, overpopulation, and religion.
Find out more about Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. Margaret Sanger's motto was, "No gods, no masters." This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we're back with our guest, who really needs no introduction, Dr. Paul Ehrlich. And I have a copy of your newest book, Paul. It's called The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution in the Environment, a beautiful yellow book with, it looks like a Maasai warrior on the top, and then an automobile. yeah, on the bottom.
I like the design that they made very much. It indicates the technological changes that we're going through cultural evolution, which is a very big part of our evolution these days.
And the acceleration of that change.
Indeed. The Dominant Animal basically, I think, should be an optimistic book. Namely, it tells us how we got to be dominant. It shows us the mistakes we're making. And it basically makes a plea to change our ways, to try and limit our population size and start it reducing as rapidly as possible, to limit our overconsumption in the rich countries while giving the people in the poor countries a chance to consume enough to have decent lives, and to adjust our technologies to stop using idiotic ones like fossil fuels that are killing us off, and switching to more benign technologies, particularly solar technologies, which could support a reasonable population if we ever get back down to a reasonable population.
So isn't it true that when countries and societies are better off, there's a more successful middle class and women have better rights, that the birth rate naturally falls? Why is that?
That's right. Well, if women have education and job opportunities, they, like men, would like to have careers, would like to get out and do something instructive, and don't want to spend their entire lives raising very large numbers of children. We had very large numbers of children because in the old days, most of them died, but now they don't. You can be blessed with one or two children, and then you should turn your thoughts to what kind of world they're going to live in, not
exactly
to how many children you want.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this, the problems with getting birth control, abortion, reproductive rights around the world.
Well, it's because, among other things, various religions have crazed ideas about what reproduction is for. I mean, the most nonsensical of which being that sex is only for reproduction. Sex in human beings is a social activity, and it's not just for reproduction. It's for fun, for bonding, and all sorts of other things. And there's absolutely no reason why we should maximize our reproduction, and people never have. The Egyptians used crocodile dung suppositories to control their reproduction rate, and I suspect
that sounds romantic.
I was going to say, I suspect, we don't know for sure, but I suspect they were very effective. So human beings just have not recently been controlling their reproduction at the right levels, and sadly, there are some organizations that fight this with crazy ideas. It's like the idea, for example, that life begins at conception. Sperm and eggs are every bit alive, as alive as presidents or university professors. Life is a continuum. When you define it as starting is a social issue. But the idea, for instance, that doddering old men ought to dictate to young women whether or not they should carry babies to term and so on is, from my point of view, just insane.
Especially doddering old men who don't get married themselves, who rule the Vatican, right?
Well, fortunately, there are an awful lot. One should not view the population problem as a Catholic problem because most educated Catholics pay no attention at all to the dictates of the church on things
this is
like
true.
Sex.
They're smarter than the Pope. Huh?
I wrote a book on evolution with a Jesuit. One of my first graduate students was a Jesuit and headed a ZPG chapter. it's the church isn't uniform. It is the old men who scare old politicians into doing the wrong things. But in general, Catholics have already voted with their genitalia. The lowest birth rates in the world are in Catholic countries in Europe.
Italy, exactly.
Italy, yeah. Spain, France, Poland. It's not an excuse for getting down on Catholics. It's a very good excuse for getting down on the Catholic hierarchy.
You have a webpage about the dominantanimal.org, right?
Yeah, just one word, dominantanimalruntogether.org, and I hope people will visit it.
Well, thank you so much, Paul Ehrlich, for being our guest today and talking to us from, I guess, your office in Stanford there.
That's right.
And we have to do it again.
I would be pleased. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
His latest book is The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment. You can hear all of our shows. They actually sound better on the podcast the second time around. You can go to ffrf.org, ffrf.org/radio, and just listen directly or sign up for the podcast.
And we invite you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation if you would like to support Free Thought Radio. We are glad to send you a complimentary issue of Free Thought Today, which is the Freedom From Religion Foundation's newspaper. The April issue will be out. You can get more information at ffrf.org. You can phone 1-800-335-4021. We don't want you to forget to vote about what should be the newest freethinking bus sign at ffrf.org/busballot. We want to invite you to tune in next week. We're going to be talking from a secular, or I guess you could even call it a free-thinking point of view, about Easter and the secular origins of spring holidays.
So do you want a pagan pulpit for next week?
That would be nice. I think we're going to have a pagan pulpit on that. I think we're going to talk a little bit about maybe what's wrong with the Ten Commandments and other secular things. So thank you very much for listening. Thanks to Paul Ehrlich for being our guest. And we invite you to tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasts.
Now, where did they go to vote on the bus sign? That's ffrf.org/bus ballot. Bus ballot slash. Okay, and then tell us what you think. If you don't like the one we picked, you can put in your own.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, ffrf.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope so.